I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
A host of complaints after indigenous activists from Brazil blocked the way into the UN climate summit in Brazil. One delegate tells us he and his colleagues need to listen to what the people living in the Amazon have to say.
And a bittersweet tribute. An American company sells a huge amount of its liqueur in Canada. But when Donald Trump's tariff war began, it was removed from Canadian liquor store shelves. So now the company has decided to move production of the brightly colored drink known as Sourpuss north of the border.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Programming on KAXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Tyler Ballgame with the song I Believe in Love. Again, that's Tyler Ballgame with the song I Believe in Love.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens.
Global warning. Indigenous activists stage multiple protests at the UN climate summit in Brazil. A delegate tells us that is because the meeting is not living up to its billing as an Amazonian COP.
A ray of hope on his last day after 5 years as Canada's ambassador to the United Nations. Bob Ray reflects on his time in the post and makes some order of the chaos.
Giving us their best shots, the U.S. company that makes sourpuss liqueur lost a huge chunk of its sales when it was taken off Canadian liquor store shelves. So to stop things from going south, they've moved production north.
The afterlife of a film about the afterlife. The late Diane Keaton made one documentary in her entire movie career, a quirky film called Heaven. Now that it's getting a posthumous re-release, its producer tells us about Ms. Keaton's vision.
Dummying the waters, a South African town is mourning the abduction of its beloved Beverly. Beverly is a mannequin in a bikini that stood in a reservoir on a country road, but has vanished without a ripple.
And you can't spell researching without sea urchin. And new research has revealed that it may look like a goth pom-pom, but the prickly sea urchin has a surprisingly complex nervous system that makes it essentially a spiky disembodied head. As it happens, the Friday edition, radio that believes no body's perfect. The sound of Indigenous activists demonstrating outside the UN climate summit in Belém, Brazil this morning. They were led by members of the Mundurucu Ipre Aya movement, who chanted, among other things, "No one enters, no one leaves." Ultimately, though, someone did both, COP30 President André Correa de Lago. And after spending 90 minutes in conversation, the protesters and the president cleared the summit entrance together. Harjeet Singh is a climate activist and a strategic advisor to the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative. He saw this morning's demonstration and earlier Indigenous-led protests at the summit. We reached him in Belém.
Harjeet, you know, the Indigenous climate activists have protested at COP more than once. What message do you think they were sending with today's demonstration as well as with Tuesday's protests, where activists actually broke through security lines?
I think it's very important to recognize that it was a peaceful protest to send a very simple message that this system is still prioritizing a corporate plunder and extractive model of development, which is what is disenfranchising them from their land and polluting their ecosystems, air, water. And that's also a cause for the climate crisis. And how our extractive-based model is prioritizing profit over people. And that message has been sent very clearly that while we are organizing this climate conference to deal with the emergency that we are facing, but at the same time, we are continuing with the model as they face agribusiness and the fossil fuel industry really taking away their lands.
This has all been billed as an Amazonian COP, but clearly those protesters, residents of the Amazon, don't feel that is the case.
That's exactly the brutal irony, because indigenous peoples are the true custodians of the Amazon and the planet's biodiversity. They are the ones, in fact, who protect the climate for all of us and the humanity. But what are we doing really in return? They are guarding the planet, and whereas we see that their lands and their resources are being taken away, they are being dispossessed. And that's why it was important to send a message that you can't just organize a climate conference in their name while continuing with the same extractive model of development unabated.
Mundurucu leadership released a statement in Portuguese saying in part, quote, "We want you to listen to us. We refuse to be sacrificed for agribusiness. Our forest is not for sale. We are the ones who protect the climate, and the Amazon cannot continue to be destroyed to enrich large corporations, unquote. They did get an audience with the summit's president, as our listeners heard a moment ago. What does that suggest to you?
Well, that suggests that the Brazilian government could understand the significance of that moment and the importance to reach out to them and talk to them to listen to their concerns. But the big question is whether that is going to change anything on the inside. Let me give you the disconnect that we see all the time, and this is not the first time, Neil, we are facing. As we speak, there is an agriculture stream of negotiations where countries like Australia or Canada or the US are, US not visibly, but we know that they are definitely behind the scenes, are trying to protect the interest of agribusiness and not regenerative farming or agroecology that is going to protect nature, that is good for people and good for the planet and good for climate, right? So we clearly see that disconnect. So when indigenous people question Brazilian government or this conference, they are absolutely right.
Just almost exactly a year ago on the show, I spoke with Indian economist Jayathi Ghosh, who had signed an open letter during the previous COP gathering in Azerbaijan. And it was calling for a complete overhaul of how these summits work. Here's a short clip from that conversation.
This whole process, the COP process, is going nowhere. And it had a lot of potential. And the Paris Agreement was a huge breakthrough, and we all hoped that this would actually reflect, especially now when things are so urgent. But what we found is that these COPs have become meaningless rituals which don't actually deliver anything. And the problems are too urgent and intense for us to keep doing these big summits that don't deliver.
When you leave Belém in about a week's time, what would you need to have seen or heard for you to feel that this wasn't a waste of time, that this was worth it?
I agree with her totally that this process has not delivered. The only thing I would like to add is we should also call out those who have not allowed this process to function, because we cannot depend on G7s and G20s. This is a place where all countries, 200 nations that come and participate, are theoretically equal. Of course, large economies have more power and there are power plays, but Tuvalu can challenge the United States and Malawi can challenge the European Union. Pacific nations can challenge Australia. There is no other space where they get so much power to speak up. So I think it's important to call those countries out. We would have or could have achieved a lot if developed countries had shown the kind of leadership that we expected them since 1992. I just want to make that very clear that this process also could have delivered, but there are people, there are powers, there are interests that have not allowed that to happen.
So it doesn't sound like when you leave that you feel that this one would have been worth it in some way, or will it? Can that change over the next week?
It can, and I must also tell you, on one hand, of course, we have criticized President Lula for allowing oil extraction or allowing agribusiness to destroy lands and really affect people in the Amazon. But at the same time, he also made a statement, particularly challenging the US and big powers, saying that we need to have a roadmap for a just transition away from fossil fuels, which is our key demand as a civil society. And as we speak, Colombian government is sharing a declaration and getting countries to sign on to that, which also talks about how we can phase out fossil fuels, which is a big step, which is something that I have not seen in several years of me attending these negotiations. I've been in this space since 2008. That is something positive. Of course, one can ask that the reality outside doesn't match with some of these words and statements and declaration. But the leadership coming from the global South countries, that's what makes things a little bit more positive. The biggest challenge that we have, and I really at this moment don't see much progress happening, is on the issue of climate finance. So that's where I would like to see much more progress over the next few days.
Harjit Singh, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Most welcome.
Harjit Singh is a strategic advisor to the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative and the founding director of the Satat Sampada Climate Foundation. We reached him in Belém, Brazil. there may be a cohort of, let's call them newly of drinking age Canadians, who've missed out on a formative beverage this year. Since U.S. President Donald Trump launched his trade war in March, Sourpuss, the U.S.-made fruity-flavored liqueur, has not been on many Canadian liquor store shelves. As a result, its Minnesota-based producer, Phillips Distilling Company, has essentially lost all of its Sourpuss sales. It turns out Canadians really love Sourpuss. Of the 1 million neon-colored bottles sold last year, 98% were sold in Canada. So to sweeten the soured relations, Phillips has moved its Sourpuss operations north of the border to Montreal. This week, its new partner distillery, Station 22, started production of the first made-in-Canada Sourpuss. Andy England is the CEO of Phillips Distilling Company. We reached him on business in Denver, Colorado.
Andy, how would you describe the flavor profile of a shot of classic raspberry Sourpuss?
Well, I think the simple answer to that would be delicious. a more complex answer would be it really is sort of sour and then sweet. I think when you taste a raspberry Sourpuss, you definitely get raspberry flavor. You definitely get hit with sour. But as it blends in your mouth, it turns sweet.
Is it your drink of choice?
Probably not. I think I certainly have had Sourpuss on a number of occasions, but I think it tends to be enjoyed by the 20-something crowd rather than the 60-something crowd.
This is the discussion that's been going on since we talked about having this conversation with you in our little pod here at As It Happens. And one of the theories we have is that perhaps the reason Sourpuss is so popular here and less popular in the United States is because the legal drinking age is lower here. What do you think?
I think we launched the product in 1998, so well before my time. I've run the company for just over 5 years. I think there were some other sour products in the market at that time, particularly from some of the larger manufacturers, and I think we stuck with it. We refused to give up, and I think we've benefited from staying true to what Sourpuss is about. I think it's a really fun brand. It's got a great, fun imagery, and I think it's really appealed to Canadians. I wish we'd had the same level of success in the U.S. We have. We sell a few cases in the U.S., but it really resonated with Canadians, and so we're delighted with that. I will say as well, I think that people who have had Sourpuss when they are young, legal drinking age, let's say, tend to go back to it a little later as kind of a nostalgia trip, So we've certainly heard about that behavior as well.
So production is underway now in Montreal. So how are you feeling about potentially being back on Canadian liquor store shelves soon?
Well, we're excited about the possibility. I will say we started bottling Phillips Butter Ripple was the very first thing to go on the line in Station 22 in Montreal on Wednesday, and I was there for that. I know that they've since produced the green Sourpuss, the apple one. I'm not sure if we've produced raspberry yet. I think it was going to be running today, but it could have been produced yesterday. I've lost track a bit.
Yeah.
But we're very excited to be in production in Canada. We think that gives us a very good argument for getting back onto shelves in Canadian provinces. But obviously, it's each province that makes their own decision about what products they're going to stock in the warehouse and where they go across the various different stores. So we think we've made a wonderful case for ourselves, and we're optimistic.
And why did you land in the end on Station 22 in Montreal?
Yeah, Station 22. Well, I will tell you, back when the tariff war began in March, it was very unclear to us when it was going to end or whether it was going to change or whether the tariff's going to get smaller, larger, go away. Is there going to be a settlement? And it was very, very unclear. And so in that spirit of uncertainty, we thought, well, the solution here, when provinces started taking us off the shelf, the solution here is to evaluate Canadian production. So that's exactly what we did. We found 19 different plants that we thought might be able to make our products in Canada. We whittled that down to three. Of the three, we met with all of them. We did an RFP such that they could provide their bid, if you like. And we selected Station 22 based on their capabilities, based on their enthusiasm for doing this, And I visited Station 22 back in May, and in the time since May, we've been preparing for production and, of course, going to a detailed contract, which I signed about a month ago. So it was a long process, but we're very excited with the result.
It's a multi-year contract. You haven't said specifically how long it's going to be. Are you considering setting up shop in Canada permanently?
Yes. Yeah, so to be clear, Station 22 is a liquor-producing facility. They produce bottled wine as well. But they are our partner. And the reason I tell people we've signed a multi-year deal, which it is, it's an agreement between private companies, so it's not one I'm willing to share more details on. But the reason I tell people it's multi-year is because we're not coming back. We're not moving. This is all our Canadian production will move up to Montreal, and it won't be coming back, certainly any time I can foresee. So I tell people it's multi-year because it doesn't matter if there's a tariff agreement tomorrow. We're not going to change our minds, regardless of what that agreement says.
Could you have imagined making a move like that a year, 2 years ago?
Probably not, because we run a substantial manufacturing facility in Princeton, Minnesota. And as anyone who knows manufacturing will know, the more volume you put through a plant, the better your financials tend to be. So pulling 150,000 cases out of our plant in Minnesota was not something we were even considering doing. And perhaps we should have considered it earlier, to be honest with you, but nonetheless, this was the tariff war was the catalyst that led us to do this. And frankly, I think we're going to be very pleased with the result. We're excited about the relationship with Station 22. They're doing a great job from a quality point of view. We think we're going to be very happy with freight rates within Canada rather than shipping to Canada. And so overall, we think it's a very good result. Now, obviously, taking 150,000 cases out of our Minnesota plant doesn't help our Minnesota plant, but we're in a fortunate position where we have some other good things going on in Minnesota with other U.S. volume going into that plant that's going to help us. So while we'll miss producing for Canada, we're delighted it's gone to Station 22, and we're delighted to be all in on the Canadian experience.
Well, Andy, I appreciate this. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Andy England is the CEO of the Phillips Distilling Company. We reached him in Denver, Colorado. It reads like a missing persons ad, only the person in question isn't one. Residents of the South African town of New Bethesda are very concerned about a mannequin named Beverly. For years, Beverly, clad in a bikini, has stood half-submerged in a small dam at a farm on a rural road in the Eastern Cape. To me, she looks like the vengeful ghost from The Ring if she was trying to get a tan, but locals have come to love her. So they're upset, because on Sunday, Beverly vanished without a trace. Rhino Grief is the local artist who installed her in her roadside home. We reached him in New Bethesda.
Rhino, take us back to the moment you learned that Beverly was gone. How did you find out she was missing?
Well, I was out of town for the weekend. We went down to a coastal town for a bit of R&R, and I got a WhatsApp the morning when I woke up. And it said that Beverly was removed from the dam. Did I have anything to do with it? And I said, no, that I didn't. I do sometimes take her out, being a mannequin and standing in the elements. She does need a bit of tightening up and things from time to time. So it is the case that I do take her out from time to time. But in this instance, it wasn't me.
Okay, and someone did search the reservoir there to make sure she wasn't just tipped over?
Yes, no, somebody went and had a look that she didn't drown, and there was no sign of her, absolutely nothing. I mean, not even, a piece or anything like that. Yeah, just gone, completely gone.
When I heard about this story before actually seeing any photographs about it, I really could not come up with any image in my mind. then I saw Beverly. And I was surprised. How would you describe her to our audience?
Well, she's a mannequin that you typically have in a shop. She was dressed, obviously, about from her belly button upwards. She was out of the water. Her arm was in a strange position because she's made up of three mannequins, not one. just those are just the pieces that I could get hold of. And she's got blonde hair and she's got a white hat on and sunglasses at one stage. Yeah, that's basically it.
Why, Rhino? Why do this?
Well, you know, it all started with a Facebook post that a local resident from our little village, New Bethesda, put out on Facebook. And she took a picture of this little dam in this arid landscape next to the road. She then, the heading was, anybody for a skinny dip? And then I returned, you know, it came past my feed again a few days later, and somebody had superimposed a skinny dipper, if I can call it like that, into the water. And then I looked at this and I thought, Al, but there's other people that also like this dam. And I thought to myself that this dam needs something, you know, it needed something. I didn't know what yet at the time, but it needed something. And then I ended up in one of the coastal towns in South Africa in a secondhand shop. And there was all these bits of mannequin lying. And I said to the guy, you know, help me. And we put something together and it looked like something. And that was it. Then I took it back to my studio, put it all together, made a stand, quite a heavy stand, because there's lots of wind that blows there, obviously, from time to time, so that she can't blow over. And then I placed her in the dam. And that's how she got there.
And how did you land on the name Beverly?
Well, what then happened is, obviously, a few people drove past there and saw her and then started talking. And so, and there was a gathering in our village, and it came out that I'd placed her there, and we, you know, people laughed and chatted about it. And then we all stood around and somebody said, well, she needs a name. And then we just as a group decided to call her Beverly.
Is Beverly's role, I mean, is it purely decorative? Is this just fun and whimsy?
It was absolutely fun and whimsy. My intention was to get a smile on people's faces. I mean, if you drive past there, you know, past this little dam on the side of a road in a very remote area, and you don't have a smile on your face when you see her, then, you know, there's something wrong with you. And she really became a landmark in the area. I mean, we have a New Bethesda Camino walking company that sends walkers around, you know, the mountain or whatever. And they walk past there every week, and there's forever photographs and things of her on Facebook. And so she became a real landmark in the area. And yeah, so people that go past there as well get to see her. And, you know, as I say, photos on social media and people in the water swimming with her and all sorts of things. It's crazy. She actually got a personality of her own, you know, in a way.
She's beloved there, clearly. I've been reading about that. Tourism officials are asking the public for any information that could lead to the return of Beverly. Are there any leads at this point?
Absolutely nothing. It is dead quiet. You know, I have no doubt that she will come out one day. It may be in a week's time, it may be in a couple of months' time, it may be in years' time. But first prize for me is that we find her somewhere. Somebody maybe placed her in a different dam or something like that. But anyway, I hope it's not malicious. I hope that it's that somebody's making a joke, you know.
Well, if she doesn't come back for a long time, if she's not returned, I mean, this is difficult to say, but is she replaceable right now? I mean, could you get something else there?
Yes, obviously, I have the thought that's crossed my mind, but there's only one Beverly, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure we'll put somebody in there. Somebody said to me the other day, you know, you have Barbie and Ken. What about a male doll this time or something?
We'll
have to wait and see.
Okay. More surprises to come. Rhino, great to speak with you. Thank you.
Fantastic, Neil. It was nice to make your acquaintance also.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Rhino Grief is a South African artist and the artist behind Beverly the Mannequin, who's currently missing in New Bethesda, South Africa. That's where we reached him. silence, thundered the evil king of the sea. You may have defeated my team of otters, but now you will pay. Off with her head. I'm nuts. I'm sorry, I'll put my laptop away. I'm sorry to be working on my novel in the middle of the show. My readers are really clamoring for book three of the Ocean Problems saga. The hero is a sea urchin named Barb. The evil king of the sea wants to execute her for concealing the jewel of Bubblemore. But how do you behead a sea urchin? You know sea urchins, the marine invertebrates that are covered with spikes. At birth, they're bilaterally symmetric, as in they have two halves that are the same, like most creatures. But in adulthood, they're pentaradially symmetric, as in they're divided into five parts that are symmetrical. Yeah, exactly, those sea urchins. Scientists wanted to figure out that change in the symmetry. So they used state-of-the-art single-cell and gene expression analyses. It's one way of doing it, I guess. Anyway, what they found was that essentially, genetically, a sea urchin's entire body is a head. Further to that, that body, which is a head, contains such a diversity of different types of neurons that a sea urchin is kind of a, quote, all-body brain. Pretty complicated nervous system for an invertebrate, but, I mean, you can see my problem. The evil king of the sea can't decapitate something with no body, so he'll have to find another way to get a head. Here's Telly with Through My Brain.
Can't get you out my head, I've been thumbing through my brain. I'm glad you said the same, normally I'd be afraid. Wish you were in my bed, I could hold you any day. Wanna see you again, but you gotta go away. Camilla Vader tea, matching my white denim jeans. The way you look at me, I can see the stream between. Eyelash off your cheek, we kiss sheets on and repeat. You were said to me, I think this feeling could. Can't get you out my head, I've been thumbing through my brain. I'm glad you said the same, normally I'd be afraid. Wish you were in my bed, I could hold you any day. Wanna see you again, but you gotta go away.
This is Telly with Through My Brain.
Quick break now, but when we come back, Bob Rae says goodbye to the United Nations after his time as Canada's ambassador there. But before we go to break, we do want to take a second to say hi to a listener. Yesterday, we got the best postcard from Graham M. in Hilden, Nova Scotia. He writes, Dear Neil Kirksall and Chris Howden, Graham, bonus points for the umlaut in my name.
Absolutely. Thank you, by the way, for not putting an umlaut in my name. He continues, by far my favorite podcast is As It Happens. Ever since I got a radio for Christmas, I've been listening to you as much as I can.
I love how the podcast is funny as well as informative, and the theme song is really catchy. You guys are doing great. Keep it up. And it is signed, your listener, Graham M., grade 6 student, Hilden, Nova Scotia.
We weren't 100% sure whether you wrote funny or punny, but we're grateful regardless. Thanks for writing, Graham. You genuinely made everyone's day here. You're doing great, and you should keep it up. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens. It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next at 7 o'clock is On the River with your volunteer host, Deborah Ann. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. And we receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. And Coats for the Community will distribute winter gear for those in need Tuesday, November 18th from 5 to 7 at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Park Rapids. Now back to As It Happens.
To say the world has changed in the last 5 years is an understatement, and at the United Nations, Bob Rae has had a front row seat. The Canadian ambassador arrived at the UN General Assembly during the first year of COVID, when much of the world was still in lockdown. Over the next 5 years, he was there for a series of pivotal moments: Afghanistan falling to the Taliban, Russia's full-blown invasion of Ukraine, October 7th, and the subsequent war in Gaza, and the ongoing displacement of millions of people all over the world because of conflict and climate change. Through it all, the UN has tried to offer the world some kind of peace and security, even when one of the most powerful men in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump, stood in front of the General Assembly and questioned its very purpose. Today is Ambassador Bob Rae's final day at the UN. We reached him in New York.
Ambassador Rae, are you all packed up at this point?
Pretty much, yeah. We're driving up tomorrow in our car, and we'll have some stuff to put in the car, but the main books and other stuff have been packed up and are in a truck somewhere. I don't know where.
You've packed up a few offices and left different roles. How does this one feel?
Yes, I have. I mean, my life has been a series of, like everybody's, exits and entrances, and I've had the chance to renew myself in different jobs over the last 55 years. So it's been quite, you know, it's really been quite wonderful. Yeah. This one has been really very mixed, and my feelings are quite nostalgic for the number of personal friendships and relationships that I've established in our mission with the people that I work with in Ottawa, with all of my colleagues and with the officials of the UN. I've had a chance to say goodbye to a lot of people, and it's been tough. But I know that there will be Monday morning. There'll be something will happen, and I'll be thinking about what else can I do. And you know, you turn the corner, and there you go.
Yeah, there's more life to live, more accomplishments.
There is.
To get to, logistically speaking, at a place like the United Nations, what actually happens when it's your last day?
Well, actually, logistically, nothing. In the sense that you slowly lose your identities, you lose your badges, you lose your phones. But it's sort of, you get stripped down in that way. But I've actually just come from a meeting at the UN where I gave a short, sharp intervention to the committee of the UN that's looking at what they call mandates, which is the way in which we tie ourselves in ropes and then prevent ourselves from doing other things. It's the methods of work which are deeply problematic at the UN, and trying to make them more efficient, and had a vigorous discussion about that issue just before I came on the air this morning.
Oh, and how do you feel having left that? Because as you well know, the United Nations has long been criticized by perhaps spending a lot of time talking and making amendments, but that it's not actually effective at the end of the day, and gridlock in the Security Council. So how did you feel after giving that short intervention?
Well, I think there's a lot of agreement. I mean, I was really encouraging everyone to, first of all, stop speaking so much from a script, try to find ways to move beyond the language that we're given from capitals, which sometimes just doesn't seem to make much sense. And there are forces at work in the UN that like tying things up and want us to be less effective. But I think there's a growing realization that the financial crisis that we're in is forcing us to make change happen. And that's, it's not been a good way to do it. It's, no one likes the methods that have been used to get there, but I think the fact that we are looking at the reform of the UN is a good idea. But it's also important to remember that the UN itself is not actually solely responsible for the mess that the world is in. That's, member states are taking care of that very nicely. And that's something that we have to recognize. As Richard Holbrooke once said, we don't blame Madison Square Gardens every time the Knicks lose. And I think that's an example that we could take to heart. It's not the building, it's not the architecture that's here, it's what member states are doing.
You were there when the U.S. president stood up at the General Assembly and said essentially, well, he said a lot of things, but he essentially said that it was a waste of time to everyone sitting there doing the work that you were doing. What was it like to sit there and listen to that?
Well, it's the second one he's given in my presence. I mean, he spoke before. It's interesting for somebody who dislikes the UN so much, he likes to come and tell us his views. It was interesting this time because there was, in other times he's spoken, there was kind of a lot of just laughter and people is listening to it in a sense of disbelief. This time it's kind of eerie because I think we all realize that not only what the American president has said, but his turning the world upside down on tariffs, turning the world upside down on Ukraine, has been dramatic and extremely consequential and difficult. Laughing it off is no longer an option. So the interesting thing is he spoke for many minutes and people listened. And it was tough.
Given some of what our listeners heard in the introduction, what you just mentioned there, the conflicts that have come up during your time in this role, is there a moment or moments that will stay with you more than others?
Oh, yeah. I think that the night, well, three, many in particular, the collapse of Afghanistan, which affected the world and all of us, particularly the Afghan people, so terribly, the takeover of the Taliban. But we went immediately into action here in New York. I mean, New York was one of the hubs that really tried to help people. And we did everything we could to help get people out and to respond and make our system work better to help it to respond. The night of the Ukraine invasion by Russia was just absolutely sobering and dramatic. Again, we tried to mobilize the public opinion in the world against what the Russians had done and were doing and are doing today. Another disastrous night in Kyiv. Again, it's not about the UN. Could the UN do anything? It's about, are the member states of the UN willing to do what's needed to be done to stop Russia? I can remember waking up in the morning with the news of the Hamas attack on October 7th, and my wife and I, Arlene, we were just shaking our heads and saying, this is going to be awful, because the reaction from Israel was what I think many people predicted would be very tough. And the impact of that attack on Israel was appalling and traumatic. And then the subsequent events have been equally and certainly traumatic, deeply traumatic, in the loss of life in Gaza. Those events have, of course, dominated the work that I've been doing and many of the things that I've had to deal with.
Yeah, I wonder how you, as you leave, compartmentalize those things or try to get them out of your head. Can you, or do they still keep you up at night?
I think you figure out a coping mechanism, but I don't think you ever get them out of your head. Mm. But the one thing that I have had to realize, and not just at this job, but in many other jobs that I've had, is that you can't let the deep tragedy of the situation prevent you from gathering your thoughts and trying to figure out, well, what can we do? How do we deal with this? Does it affect you emotionally? Absolutely. And I think Canadians who've seen me sometimes wiping a tear from my eye or actually having difficulty finishing a sentence will know that it does have an impact. Of course it does.
Another notable moment you were there for was in September when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke at the United Nations and criticized countries, including Canada, for recognizing the state of Palestine. And as you know, dozens of diplomats walked out. You remained seated. Why did you make that decision?
Well, because I felt that it was important for Canada to be in the room, and I felt it was important for us to listen to what he was saying. I disagreed strongly with much of what he said, but I thought that to simply join a walkout was not where where Canada should be, and there was never any doubt that Canada would stay. But when somebody said to me, "Will you be in the room for Netanyahu's speech?" I said, "Yes." I have actually made a point at the UN of sitting and listening to a lot of speeches. At the very beginning, I made a point of listening to when President Abbas, the Palestinian Authority, and the Prime Minister, both Prime Minister Netanyahu, both spoke. And I made a point of just saying, I'm going to sit here and listen and take notes and really try to figure out the language and the arguments that they're making and how this can change, move in a different direction. And I continue to believe that's something that that has to be done.
In diplomacy, it can be, there are many things that are difficult about it, I'm sure. But for someone who has earned, some listeners may not know, the nickname Hurricane Bob, what was that like for someone who, you know, was known for going against the government's official stance on some things to try to balance that in this role?
Oh, I was very, very determined to do it. I mean, I think one has to appreciate the fact that there are still voices out there in the world, far too many, who believe that Israel doesn't have a right to exist as a country in the Middle East. And that is not my position. It's not Canada's position. I have done everything I can to encourage the government of Canada to move to the recognition of the state of Palestine. And many in the Jewish community objected strongly to that and said, how can you do that after what happened on October 7th? And I said, look, there's no way we're going to be able to resolve the conflict in the Middle East until we recognize the fundamental point that there is a dignity of difference, and that the difference of Palestine has to be recognized with dignity, and the difference of Israel has to be recognized with dignity. I think that's a position that I have been proud to maintain, even though, frankly, I received tons of hate mail and all kinds of other forms of communication. And I expect always a risk that will continue to happen. But I continue to believe fundamentally that this is not going to be solved by simply saying I'm for this and I'm not for that, and that place I will never go, this place I will never go. We have to find ways of reaching accommodation between two countries that need to live together in peace and dignity. We're a long way from that, but we have to work to try to get there.
Of all the roles and jobs you've had, what did this one teach you about yourself, Ambassador?
That's a good question. It's been the kind of culmination, or maybe the closing of a circle. As you know, my dad had this job 50 years ago, and it took a lot of out of him at a difficult time in the life of the world. And I can remember when the Prime Minister offered me this job, that there was an irony to it, but also a good irony. I learned. I'm actually a better listener than I think some people would think that I am. I learned how to get along with a lot of people, and I think I helped make a difference. And I must say, I've been very touched by the positive responses that my colleagues in the UN have expressed. And I also, you know, as I decided to take this moment to leave, that there's other phases and other things that I'd still like to do. So I'm proud to have been able to do this, but I'm looking forward to the next chapter.
And what is that? Have you nailed that down? Have you decided, or is it a little bit of a break first?
Well, perhaps you don't know this, but I've been asked to become the host of As It Happens.
we have a third chair in here. Come on in.
No, seriously, I'm looking at a range of things, but I have not concluded anything yet. I will be coming back to Toronto. My family and my children and grandchildren are in the city. I'm looking forward to being with them, but I won't be retiring. I'll be doing some writing. I hope to be doing some teaching and some public speaking, and I'm looking forward to continuing my life of engagement.
Ambassador Ray, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. Take care.
Bob Ray is Canada's outgoing ambassador to the United Nations, and maybe my replacement. He's in New York. It's a city like Miami or Los Angeles, where all the men look like Burt Reynolds. That's one vision of the afterlife presented in a 1987 film called Heaven. It's a quirky documentary that mixes interviews with old film clips and music, and it's the only documentary directed by the Oscar-winning actress Diane Keaton, who died just a month ago. Here's David Letterman interviewing Ms. Keaton shortly after the film was released.
Now, the film, you pose many questions pertaining to heaven. Like, what was the question?
Is there sex in heaven?
Is there sex in heaven?
Is, you know, how do you get there? Mm-hmm. And are you afraid to die?
And what did you find these answers were?
These answers were varied, to say the least, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As answers tend to be.
Yes, they certainly do, yes.
But as far as is there sex in heaven, what is your particular... First of all, do you think that there is a heaven? You probably do, or you wouldn't have done this project.
I don't know for sure.
Not for sure.
What do you think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, ooh.
Yeah, probably, yeah. No, yeah, I do. Just like a really mm-hmm. big gymnasium.
This is right.
I understand it's a very interesting piece
of
work.
Oh, you do? Mm. I hope so.
A newly restored version of Heaven gets a special re-release today. Arnie Holland is the film's executive producer. We reached him in Studio City, Los Angeles.
So, for Arnie, for Diane Keaton fans, that's vintage Diane Keaton speaking to David Letterman all those years ago about that documentary, Heaven. When you hear what she had to say, what does that conjure up for you?
A very warm feeling about her. That's such a great interview. Yeah. She obviously really loved the project and went out there and promoted it. We also had it at Cannes. It was in the director's fortnight, which is just for first-time directors, and we had a big press conference, and I remember worrying if she was really going to get on the plane and come, but she did, and it was a fun time. I remember taking her and her friends out to dinner in a gorgeous French restaurant, and she had Carol Kane there, who was one of her best friends, and Carol had a boyfriend at the time named Woody Harrelson.
Really?
And who actually sat right next to me.
How old was he then?
I wish I had talked to him more, because I didn't really know him. He had only been on Cheers.
You know, fans of Diane Keaton, I think, imagine her, you know, to or saw her as someone who loved life and really lived it fully. And they may not know that she had this, maybe obsession's too strong of a word, but she was really fascinated by this idea of heaven and the afterlife. What did she tell you about why she wanted to direct this film?
This came in and we were like, yeah, we love Diane Keaton, whatever she wants to do. And, you know, we were in New York, she was in California, and she and her producer, Joe Kelly, put together the whole movie. We gave her complete creative freedom. We did not tell her what to do. We funded it. Then we sat back and watched when she brought it in.
And what did you think? Because I think quirky is one word we can use to describe it. What did you think when you sat down for that screening?
It was very Diane. It was it was the woman we had seen on screen. It was the woman we saw in our offices telling us what the film was going to be about. And she was quirky, yes, kooky, funny. You know, this is a question that has interested and maybe been for millennia. Just, it's an age-old question, a mystery that has never been solved. It's the unknowable. And so, you know, an exploration of what people think it might be like just sounded wonderful to me.
So why did you think this was the perfect time to re-release it?
Well, she passed, and I was thinking about a relationship that we had with her and, you know, mourning her in my own way. And then theaters started to contact me wanting to screen the movie. And I was like, whoa, the interest in Diane is really high. She's on the news a lot. We need to quickly remaster this film to get it into shape to screen at theaters and put it out again on a Blu-ray this time. It's never been on a Blu-ray. It was always in standard definition. And so we remastered it from 480 to 1080p, so it's now high def. And in the theaters, we got one in L.A. I'm going to doing the Q&A tonight at the Philosophical Research Center. They have a big theater in Los Feliz, which is going to be so much fun, a whole room full of philosophers talking about the unknowable. And that's tonight. And then we have screenings in Albuquerque, in Canada, at Hot Docs in Toronto at December 27th. And then it's going to be in New York, in Brooklyn in January, and at Lincoln Center in February.
Do you think she would have gotten a kick out of that?
I think she's up there in heaven, you know, laughing and getting a kick out of it. Exactly.
What do you want audiences, maybe the ones the folks you'll talk to tonight or at other screenings, what do you hope people in 2025 take from it?
Well, what this film does is it causes conversation afterwards, because everybody has their own opinion. And it's a subject you don't talk about much because everyone's afraid of dying. So this brings it out into the open and gives people a chance to talk about their own views, which are, as Diane proved, that whether you're a religious person or an atheist or a kid on the street or one of her family members, everybody has a different point of view.
Arnie, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
I'm so glad you had me on. Thank you.
Arnie Holland is the executive producer of Diane Keaton's documentary, Heaven. We reached him in Studio City, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Nielke Oksal. Goodbye.
This is 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids.